Welcome to Oncology Today, optimizing biomarker assessment and related treatment decision-making for patients with hormone receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love, and I met with Dr. Seth Wander from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston to discuss the role of biomarker assessment in the management of hormone receptor-positive disease. To begin, I asked Dr. Wander to comment on how he approaches the use of tissue and liquid biopsy in patients with metastatic breast cancer.
I'm going to answer this two ways. I'm going to sort of play devil's advocate on both sides. In my own practice, if somebody's diagnosed with metastatic disease, they virtually always have a biopsy proving it at the time of metastatic diagnosis. So we already have that tissue. So I will typically send that tissue for sequencing because you saw there were some discordant cases, for example, where PIK3CA is picked up on solid but not on liquid. I will do a concurrent liquid biopsy at baseline to kind of set the stage for where we're starting with all these genes. Typically for progression, I tend to prefer liquid biopsy for all the reasons that we talked about. We may get a solid biopsy if, for example, the patient was HER2 zero and I'm trying to figure out if they're eligible in the future for TDXD. We may get a solid biopsy if there's like oligo progression in one area and not others to figure out if the receptor status has changed. And if I get another biopsy, I'll send it for sequencing. I think the bigger question that you're alluding to is, should we be doing repeat solid biopsies because of the discordance that can occur? And I think if your suspicion is high enough, where you're really looking for other treatment options, it's not unreasonable, but of course it's putting the patient through more invasive procedures. I'd like to think, and I do believe this, that the technology is getting better and better and better. The threshold of detection for the liquid assays is getting lower and lower and lower. And I hope that over time, the discordance that we're seeing, which I showed you a few different papers, it was on the order of anywhere from 10 to 30%, that actually that number is going to shrink and shrink over time because the liquid biopsies are actually moving at the speed of light. So I think the general consensus of if you have to choose, liquid is sort of safer and better and easier is true. But I don't think we should assume that every single mutation will always be caught on liquid biopsy. That's the way that I would kind of hedge on that.
Yeah, that's sort of news to me. Another thing you mentioned was, I always hear the word epigenetic, and to be honest, I don't know if I'm the only one who doesn't really understand sort of what that means biologically, but what does it mean, and are there markers that sort of evaluate that?
Yeah, it's a frontier area, not just for breast cancer, but in many different tumor types. The way that I think of epigenetics is the architecture of the chromatin. So remember, most of the DNA, the vast majority of the DNA in the chromosomes is non-coding. There's no genes in there. But it impacts the shape that the chromosomes take, and it's packed so tightly together that all of that non-coding DNA shapes the architecture and the ability of the transcriptional machinery to get into the gene, right, to turn it on. So epigenetics refers to methylation changes on the DNA that opens it or closes it and allows the machinery to get into the genes to turn them on or blocks the machinery and turns it off. And what we've started to appreciate is that a ton of oncogenic events, turning this gene on or turning that gene off, may not be detected by conventional sequencing, which is looking for a hit in the DNA code. It might be some change in the methylation markers on the DNA around it that changes the architecture and blocks the transcription or encourages the transcription of the genes. And so some newer technology, and I would love to come back and talk about it, we can actually start to profile the methylation changes across the genome by the blood. And that will then tell you whether gene A, RB, P10, pick your gene, is turning on or turning off. And that would be totally undetectable, for example, by targeted sequencing of different genes. So I call this the sort of, we used to call it the dark matter of CDK resistance. When I was a postdoc and we were working in the lab, there'd be 25 to 33% of patients. We could not find anything on solid biopsy, on liquid biopsy. There was no RB, there was no AKT, there was no RAS, but the patient was resistant to CDK. So we hypothesized that there's some other events, whether it's the DNA architecture, the methylation changing expression of the gene, whether it's post-translational changes to the protein, whether it's happening, through some other pathway that we don't know. And so I think we're actually going to start to uncover a lot of that dark matter of resistance, looking at RNA-based changes, looking at methylation, epigenetic changes, some really cool technology coming along to help us do that with a blood biopsy.
Another thought I had as you were going through that talk was, I don't know how to put it exactly, other than I was thinking a lot about prostate cancer and PSA and how helpful that is clinically. And what I saw in your talk in a number of places was what looks to be the opportunity to really start to look at how therapy affects biomarkers. Again, something kind of new, at least to me. But this TK level thing sounded really interesting. Can you just kind of go back through that and talk about where you see that heading? It seems like it would have an important clinical role.
I agree. We're jealous of our friends in GU Oncology, because I think you would agree with me, and you know more about all the different cancer types than anybody that I know. And so I'm curious how you're going to respond to this. I think PSA is the best easily accessible biomarker in any tumor, bar none. Like I can't think of another example where 99% of the patients express it, right? And it's a dynamic change. So we're jealous of that in breast cancer, right? We've got CA15-3 and CA27-29, but they're nowhere near as sensitive or specific as PSA. So we have an unmet need, as do many other tumor types. And the TK test, the thymidine kinase test, which we've worked with them to help develop this, is really cool. And I'll show you a couple of cases in a few minutes on that. So the way I think about TK is, it's almost, Neil, like Ki-67, right? Which is a good metric of sort of how the tumor cells are dividing, but you can test it in the blood. So the higher the thymidine kinase level in the blood, the more cell cycle you have, the more G1 to S, you know, transition you have. So think about a drug like a CDK inhibitor, which acts by blocking cells in G1. They can't divide. You should expect your TK, your thymidine kinase level, to plummet if you're stopping cell division, right? And so TK is a beautiful test for any kind of drug where you're actually measuring the amount of tumor cell division, and you want to do it in a quick, non-invasive way. And the test comes back in a couple of days. Like, it's not a 3-week or a 6-week send out. I'll show you some data that we've been developing from different patients. But to me, there's at least two ways to think about a TK test, for example, in ER-positive breast cancer. And we talked about one of them today. You can develop with three time points: baseline, halfway on cycle one, and off drug at the beginning of cycle two, the pattern. If there's no drop in cell division, no drop in TK, those patients are not responding to the CDK, and they're likely to progress earlier. You can say this patient's going to get an inferior outcome most likely compared to somebody who has a deep drop in thymidine kinase. The rebounders are interesting. The rebounders are saying they have some response to CDK, but when you're on that off week, the tumor cells are starting to divide. And so they're somewhere in between. So the first thing you can do with the TK level is look at the patient within a month and say, I can pretty accurately predict where you're going to fall on this PFS curve for Mona Lisa 2 or Paloma 2, or pick your trial. The second thing that's interesting, which we didn't talk about yet, but makes sense, let's say, like Serena 6, now the patient's doing well, they're on AICDK, you could check a TK every 2 and 3 months. Once it starts rising, once that TK level starts to rise, it's sort of like ctDNA, the ESR1 rising, but we're not just looking at ESR1, we're looking at total tumor bulk. And my colleague Cynthia Ma at WashU is doing great work on this as well. She has beautiful data from patients who, they have a TK level that starts to rise months in advance of a scan, right, showing any kind of clinical progression. So I could imagine a future state where you take the TK level to predict kind of who's going to do well on a CDK inhibitor from the beginning. We've been developing clinical trials to think about how to escalate therapy in patients who don't get a good drop. And then you're using it to monitor. And once you start to see the rise, now we're going to check ctDNA, see is there ESR1, is there AKT, is there P10, is there something we can target when the TK... So it's like a global tumor marker that, I think you're right, PSA is the best kind of analogy to that, because it's a kind of a universal thing, right? It should be reliable if the cancer cells are dividing.
So, you know, kind of a follow-up to that would be, is this specific to endocrine therapy of breast cancer, or is it just basically a good tumor marker for any therapy, breast or otherwise, even outside of breast?
I think it could be a good tumor marker outside of breast, because again, that G1 to S checkpoint is not unique
makes
to breast
sense.
Cancer. Anytime you have tumors that are dividing, you're going to have thymidine kinase levels in the blood. Now, as you know, I'm sort of a one trick pony. Like I only do my work in breast cancer, so I'm not as familiar with what kind of data has been collected. Immediately, you think about other hormone dependent, you know, either gynecologic or prostate. But I agree with you. I think even a non-hormonally dependent tumor where you have drugs that are blocking cell division, it would work. The thing that probably wouldn't work is that rebound pattern. The reason the rebound thing works is because you're 3 weeks on, 1 week off. You're getting a look at what the tumor's doing during the off week. If you don't have a three on, one off, you could still use TK just as a measurement of tumor division, but you can't generate that unique profile. So that's, I think, unique to the CDK. But you could still follow TK just like you would follow ctDNA. I think both ctDNA globally, like the amount of ctDNA in the blood, and TK are future biomarkers to look at the activity of a cancer, right? If you just set aside the presence or absence of ESR1 or the presence of absence of P10 or AKT, just the amount of ctDNA, if there's more ctDNA in the blood, that's a bad sign, right? That's a sign that there's more cancer cells. I happen to think probably the TK is a little more sensitive than that. But it's the same idea, and it's the same idea as the PSA, a universal kind of biomarker that could be used to find subclinical progression before the patient's symptomatic, before there's millions of cancer cells growing on the skin.
So a couple of specific questions that came out of your really great slides looking at NGS. So, I mean, I know it's not the emphasis here, but I have to ask you, just looking at the algorithms you had there, in terms of looking for BRCA, if you have a negative NGS, do you need to do germline?
It's a technically yes, because those NGS tests are not specifically designed for germline assessment. The implications in my experience are, if it's not detected on NGS, the likelihood of having a germline mutation is exceedingly low. And typically, I also tell the fellows, if you have NGS and you see a BRCA where the allelic frequency is on the order of 30 to 60%, it's a really good chance that they have germline, right? Because it's probably there in about half the cells. But we can't use that. We still have to confirm it with a sort of CLIA-approved germline, germline test. But you have somatic BRCA. So if I see a BRCA with an allelic fraction of 1% or less than 1%, that's almost definitely not germline. It's probably acquired in the cancer. And we have data coming along that acquired, HRD changes like acquired BRCA, they can still be sensitive to PARP inhibitors as well. We've had some trials looking at that. So, but yes, I take your point, and I agree that typically there's a pretty good correlation on somatic sequencing for what you might expect with like a germline change.
A couple other things that sort of popped up on your chart there that I thought was interesting. Have you ever had a patient with an FGFR alteration or a RET fusion that you treated with targeted therapy? I didn't think about that.
I haven't. And I've treated thousands of patients. One of these days, I'm going to come back to you and say, yes, I found NTRK. I found my NTRK patient, or I found the RET patient. I have had patients with very high TMB. I have had a couple of patients with high MSI. I have had FGFR patients, although, again, sometimes the FGFR is an amplification event. Sometimes it's a point mutation. We have some nice data that we're generating looking at resistance to CDK inhibitors and PI3K pathway inhibitors with FGFR. I think that's actually a really underappreciated target in ER-positive breast cancer. I have used immune therapy in those cases sometimes where the TMB is high or the MSI is high. I would love to use the NTRK inhibitor if I could find it. I hear about it in tumor board. Once in a while, I'll do a bunch of tumor boards and I'll hear about it. It's tough though, because, and I'm sure many of your other colleagues who you've done these sessions with will say this, I find TMB not to be the best predictor of response to like immune therapy. It's one of those things where, if I have a patient who's got a TMB of 15 or 20, it's a little bit high. The track record in ER-positive breast cancer really isn't great if you look across the whole population. I have a couple of patients where the TMB is like in the hundreds. I feel a little bit more excited about using it if it's really high, right? If the cutoff is 10 and I have a patient who's in like the 80 to 100 plus range, I'm saying, okay, this patient's way off the chart, like standard deviation. But I have used some of those tumor agnostic. The HER2 kinase blockers in somebody with an acquired HER2 mutation, those are acquired changes that provoke resistance to endocrine and CDK.
So I sort of hesitate to bring this up because you already talked about so many trials, but there was one trial you didn't talk about because you were focused on metastatic disease. But I want to ask you about it in terms of a lot of the concepts that you just talked about And of course, that's the LADEERA study, where you didn't have ESR1 mutations, and yet you have a SERD. I don't know whether it was because of efficacy or tolerability or whatever, but I mean, I know we're not here to talk about LADEERA necessarily, but I do think it kind of relates, you know, sort of getting back to, you know, the, you know, kind of original SERD papers comparing SERDs to other therapy where people were looking for it to be better. And I was sitting there going, well, it looks like it says good. So how do you explain LADEERA where they don't have ESR1 mutations and yet did better?
Yeah, it's a great, great question. I'm going to answer this a couple different ways. So LADEERA is an interesting study, of course. Giredestrant could be a tough conceptual drug for our fellows and for our community practice doctors. And here's why. Think about, for example, pembrolizumab in triple negative breast cancer. Pembrolizumab, to get it approved in metastatic disease, you have to be PD-L1 positive. But in adjuvant, neoadjuvant Keynote, you don't need to test PD-L1. Same drug, same disease. In the early stage setting, there's no biomarker. In the metastatic setting, there is a biomarker. That's conceptually a little difficult. Imagine giredestrant in a relatively near future state where evERA, because of the data you and I just reviewed, gets an ESR1. You need ESR1 to give giredestrant everolimus in the metastatic setting. But LADEERA, per the point you just made, there was no stratification for ESR1. All comers did very well. So you could have a situation where if you have early stage disease, you could give giredestrant to kind of anybody. But in metastatic disease, you might only be able to give it for ESR1. I don't know if that's the case. I'm not on those panels. I'm just guessing. Now, why would it work? I'm going to be at cynical is the wrong word. I think if LADEERA had been sort of weakly positive or negative, but the ESR1 subset did well, everybody would have said, oh, that's obvious. Those drugs only work with ESR1. But since LADEERA worked, everybody says, oh, that's obvious. It's preventing the emergence of ESR1. And that's why it works, right? It's all like 20/20 hindsight. My feeling about LADEERA is a combination of a few different things. I think it is a better estrogen blocker, for lack of a better word, or degrader than tamoxifen or an AI. To your point, I think these drugs are better tolerated, so there's more treatment persistence. We saw that in SERENA-6. And I think it's preventing the most common bypass pathway, which is the acquisition of ESR1. So between those three things, it's a better drug, it's better tolerated, so people stay on it longer, and it's preventing the key mechanism of resistance. Now, one of the things I worry about, and this is not a reason not to use the drug, this just means we have to do our work right in the academic setting. What comes out of that? Who progresses on LADEERA and what does their tumor look like? Almost certainly it won't be ESR1, right? Because you're blocking those clones. It's going to be the stuff you were just asking about. HER2, acquired mutations, RAS, pathway alterations, AKT, P10, ER loss, you know, probably looking more like a triple negative. We need to see. That doesn't mean we shouldn't use it because you're hopefully curing more patients. When you have progression, the phenotype of the tumor changes. The best example of that is if you and I had been talking 5 to 10 years ago and you asked me before CDK inhibitors, what's the average time on fulvestrant in the second line metastatic? I would say, oh, you know, 12 months, like 10 months. If you ask me now, two months, right? 3 months. We did that. By using CDK inhibitors, we changed the genomic structure of the tumors and we actually made them more virulent, for lack of a better word.
No, I remember when those papers came out and I was like, I thought fulvestrant was a good drug, but not in that situation, the 2 month PFS. One other sort of quick thing, I'm always having a problem trying to figure out when we're writing stuff, what term to use related to AKT alterations. And I noticed that one of your slides, you had the term PAM pathway, PAM pathway, yeah. P-A-M. Yeah. What does that stand for?
So that's PI3K-AKT-mTOR pathway. So that's basically saying the
okay.
whole pathway.
Wow. Perfect. Good. You know, okay, I like it. Yeah.
I think about that, Neil, because of the Geda drug, the gedatolisib, is a PI3K-AKT-mTOR. So they call it a PAM inhibitor.
Huh. Wow. That's good. I like it. Okay. Another question is, you had this really cool slide there. I thought it was incredible. I know you sort of made it up where you see the mutation status of a patient over time. And I realized that you created this as sort of an artwork thing, but it's just so informative to be able to look at this. And I'm curious whether you think in the future, this is the kind of thing we're going to see on a lab result.
Yes, this is actually from a garden test. what you see on the Guardant report is if you scroll down, and we can do this as an exercise one day, there's for each gene, they show you, if you have multiple Guardant tests, they'll show you at each time point what the level of the gene was. But then you can look at the whole picture, like the whole spectrum of mutations. And what you see here is, as time goes on, and I put the part at the bottom, which is diagnosis, resistance to antiestrogens, when you treat with the drug, you see that the patient gets more complex mutations, and the new colors that come up is each one a different mutation. Each one of those is different. And I'm just tagging which one. If you look on the key, it tells you which mutation is which color. So the green, the light green is ESR1. The dark blue is PIK3CA. The dark blue, you notice, is there the whole time. And the frequency, which is the thickness of the color, is about the same for the dark blue, the PIK3CA. But the light green didn't exist at time zero diagnosis, but now is, you know, got a reasonable frequency because that's acquired, right? So truncal is the ones that are present at baseline. Acquired are the new colors that are present on the far right. I'm hesitant to bring this up. I'll send this to you because you could take this to a whole nother level. We did a paper that's in review. It's about to be published, hopefully, in I think it's going to be in NPJ Precision Oncology, where we looked at patients who had at least 10 different variants in ESR1. So they had 10 different types of ESR1 mutations. And you should see these plots in those patients, where they may have dozens of different mutations at one time, right? And the software generates this plot with all different colors and all different things. And you can see when you treat the patient and you retest after treatment with certain drugs, some of the mutations collapse and disappear, some of them increase. And we were simply trying to demonstrate the complexity of the clonal architecture on and off antiestrogens and on and off chemo and on and off ADCs. So this one has, you know, three genes to begin with, and maybe 10 genes later. Imagine a patient who has a report with 30 genes or 50 genes, right? Trying to decode the complexity of that is very interesting.
So a couple other things, and then again, we'll get to your cases. But I agree with you. That presentation in San Antonio from Serena, where you saw the allelic fraction drop down, was very impressive. And again, it seems like it's something that has clinical relevance now. I mean, I don't know. Do you get serial assays and people you already are treating with a SIR to see whether it's dropping or not? I mean, it kind of looks like a tumor marker.
Oh, I completely agree. And I actually think, to the point that you brought up earlier, if we were to test total burden of ctDNA, allelic fraction of ESR1, or thymidine kinase level, they would all, if I showed you a plot of all three of those things, they would all look exactly the same. Because they're all measuring the same outcome, which is sort of dynamic on treatment changes in tumor burden. We've started to recheck ctDNA on treatment. I think once we have a kind of a formal FDA approval for Serena 6, it'll be a bit easier to kind of get that testing done all the time. Right now, you know, you worry a little bit about, will it get reimbursed, you know, at the same rate? Do we have to work with the company to sort of get things paid if the patient's not obviously progressing? I think it's going to turn out, Neil, to be a great biomarker, any of those things, but certainly dynamic ESR1 changes. To me, everybody looks at that plot and says, wow, look, it's 100% median reduction. So cool. I look at that plot and say, what about the 5 or 10 patients who didn't drop to zero? What's going on with them? We have some ideas as to what might happen to them, but I've talked to my friend Dr. Bedard and the team at Serena 6 to say, well, let's do a deep dive on the 7 or 8 patients who didn't get to zero and try to figure out what the resistance mechanisms are, because you'll learn a lot about who maybe shouldn't get an oral SERD.
You know, another thing I was thinking about is that we've been doing a series now on ctDNA and oncology in multiple tumors, including breast, and I kind of had kind of put over on this side those type of assays, you know, like Signatera and assays like ESR1. But as you were going through this, they kind of were coming together in my own mind. So it's almost like it seems like it's sort of the same concept, just much more targeted to one, like you were saying, like PSA and prostate. So do you see a role for, quote, you know, an assay like Signatera and breast cancer?
Yes, definitely. And we've got, you know, very exciting data for breast cancer. The problem is, I think you'll agree with those assays, at least in breast cancer, is we know that prognostically it's very powerful. Like if your Signatera is positive in the early stage setting, you know, you're likely to have a recurrence. We don't know what to do about it. Like what is the actionability? You could imagine a situation in the not too distant future where we're monitoring for MRD with something like Signatera. It flips positive. We then immediately test for ESR1. If it's positive, go to an oral SERD, just like, you know, with the Lidera, you know, through the Lidera or Ember4 or Elegant. The idea being we're monitoring the patient, we detect tumor DNA, we figure out if it's driven by ESR1, and we switch them to an oral SERD without anything on a scan, right, with no abnormalities detectable yet on imaging. That, to me, would be a great use of this technology moving earlier in time for patients.
So one other question. You were talking about these new AKT inhibitors, this one without a name, RLY-2606, as an example. And having just done a webinar last night on hyperglycemia with AKT PIK3 agents, that was pretty complicated. I was just curious. One thing you didn't show, I don't think, was toxicity. You kind of wonder, do you see less toxicity with you, since it's targeting the mutation as opposed to the wild type?
Yeah, great question. And some of them are getting names. It's hard to keep up with exactly which one is getting which name because now they're moving into phase three. There's a bunch of these next generation PI3K mutant specific and now AKT mutant specific drugs. And yes, I didn't show the toxicity just in the interest of time because we were doing biomarkers. But yes, the hyperglycemia rates are dramatically lower because the hyperglycemia is the wild type PIK3CA side effect, right, of using the first generation agents. So some of these studies and drugs were even tested in patients with diabetes, right? And they were doing okay. So the newer drugs have a much better therapeutic window, right? Like much less off-target wild type. But the downside maybe is that because it's so specific to the mutation, you're going to be able to get secondary mutations in AKT, P10, and maybe even other PIK3CA mutations that could cause resistance. We don't know that for sure yet. We're working on it. That's the flip side of that is the gedatolisib data, where it's not mutant specific. It goes across PI3K, AKT, and mTOR, but because it's IV, you have less hepatic metabolism and some of the side effects. It actually also has, you know, lower hyperglycemia rates, even though it's not a mutant-specific isoform. The downside is it's 3 weeks on IV, 1 week off, so we have to kind of work our heads around that in the clinic. So the newer drugs, whether they're the IV formulation or the oral mutant-specific, to your point, are going to have a lot better toxicity window, and we're going to be able to give these drugs to a lot more people.
So one final sort of global question that we've talked a lot about over the last few years, and I'm just kind of rethinking, is the clinical situation where you have both, a PAM alteration. Is that what you say nowadays?
Sure.
Okay. and ESR1, both, yeah, which is not rare at all. It does happen. And which way are you going to go? And, you know, we've talked about, we've done surveys trying to figure out what people do clinically. But sort of relevant to that, again, last night when we were talking about AKT and all, and we were going back to the original studies, I was looking at them going, wow, those hazard rates are really impressive, particularly when you treat earlier, like with inavolisib, where you start at first line. And then I was thinking about what we see with SERDs and ESR1 mutant. So I know it's indirect comparison, but just kind of curious, because I know there are a lot of factors people consider in making that decision. But, and of course, when you have both, I don't know if that's different, but you have a sort of an inherent feeling that whether or not one has more efficacy than the other.
Yeah, it is the key question right now in clinic, and we're actually generating some data on this with institutional experience and real world data, and I think that'll complement the surveys that your team has done very nicely to try to answer that question, which is, does it matter which one you give first? Can you give them in sequence? I'll answer this a couple of different ways. First, I think it depends a lot on the patient, right? What are their medical comorbidities? How bad is the disease? What rate is the progression? I wouldn't use the allelic fraction to make the decision because almost always the PIK3CA is going to be a higher allelic fraction. And some might argue that the lower allelic fraction is the new thing. That's the thing that's causing the progression. So you could argue it both ways. I tend to prefer doublet therapy for patients who had a less robust control on their frontline drugs, for patients who have more disease and you need to be a little bit more aggressive. I tend to prefer the oral SERD monotherapy for patients with maybe less aggressive progression, you know, patients who had a much longer duration on their frontline therapy. The side effects are obviously much easier and the monitoring is much easier on the oral SERD than to put them on the, you know, the PAM pathway inhibitor. The last thing I always say about this is, it's a huge problem right now, but it's temporary because you have these next-gen PI3K inhibitors coming. They're going to be combined with next-gen antiestrogens. So we're going to have perfect combos where we have a good oral SERD or a SERM or a CERAN or something combined with a good next-generation PAM PI3K AKT inhibitor. So we have this moment where this is going to be a big issue. We're trying to write some papers and look at this. And then 5 years from now, you and I are going to be talking and be like, remember when we had to choose between these things? That was weird, right? Like that, you know, that was like a crazy time when we had to make those hard choices.
So just a couple other quick questions I just forgot I was going to ask you about before we get to the cases. A couple of your publications, of which there sure are a lot. You have like a publication house up there, but anyhow, a couple of them I wanted to ask you about. One is in a journal, but I'm just curious. ESPWA, a deep learning-enabled tool for precision-based use of endocrine therapy in resource-limited settings. Is this like AI for what we're talking about here?
A colleague of mine works in AI at MGH and asked for some assistance on the breast cancer side. That's a really cool thing. What they're doing is they have digitized pathology, for example, from Haiti, where the patient gets biopsied and it's very hard for them to get ER, you know, PRHER2 testing done in resource-limited setting. So they've created an AI algorithm where they've trained based on thousands and thousands of samples. They can take a snapshot, a picture of a slide from a tumor, no stain, no ER stain, no PR stain, and the AI algorithm can tell you with pretty high confidence whether it's ER positive or not. And so you don't give the wrong tamoxifen or anastrozole or whatever to a patient who's ER negative, and you are more confident that you're giving it to the right. So I was sort of a consultant on that paper just to kind of from the breast cancer side help them understand the right questions, but the other authors did the AI work on that for us. Hopefully that'll be published in a peer-reviewed journal soon.
That's interesting. Do you see AI being of any assistance in this type of realm in terms of, you know, taking profiles of biomarkers and providing some kind of input to oncologists?
I think it will. I think it will be helpful, especially as we have more and more genes and we have more and more types of testing. So imagine a situation where you have multiple targets, you're trying to decode across different platforms like TK or like RNA and like DNA, and you can create an algorithm to help you predict, you know, which patient would do better on this drug versus that drug. I think we're only scratching the surface as to how those decision support tools might be deployed, particularly in practices where, you know, with all of your other colleagues, the speed with which it's moving with all these new approvals in GI and thoracic and myeloma and melanoma, right, and lymphoma, you have to have some support to read the clinical data, the pathology data, the genomic data, and to understand these are my choices and these are the outcomes, right, with the top choice or the middle choice or the bottom choice. So I think there's great potential for this sort of technology with complex data input.
Yeah, when I think about all the stuff you just went through and thinking about a general medical oncologist has got to, you know, figure out what to do about neoadjuvant therapy of bladder cancer, et cetera. Real challenge. One other paper caught my attention. I didn't get a chance to read it, but I'm real curious about it. Well, it's several papers, actually, same topic. Comparative efficacy of first versus second-line CDK inhibition.
Yeah, I have a great student who's rotating with us, and she's very good at doing some of these meta-analyses. We were trying to take a look at kind of the SONIA approach, right? Do you have to use a CDK inhibitor in the frontline versus later setting? And we're trying to do meta-analyses of how patients do. And I think the point here is we as a community of drifted toward the idea of deploying CDK inhibitors in the frontline setting across the board, there are probably situations where patients, for example, who may be at higher risk of toxicity or may have less aggressive, more indolent bone-only disease, could get away with going with endocrine therapy alone. Neil, one of the things that you'll be interested to hear is we've proposed a trial, we're trying to get it funded, where we use the TK test. And if you have deep suppression of the TK, you pull back the CDK inhibitor, because maybe those are highly endocrine sensitive patients who don't need the financial toxicity and the monitoring for CDK. So that meta-analysis was meant to kind of examine and recapitulate the SONIA data, but sort of set the stage for this argument that if we had a better biomarker, we could predict who doesn't need all that cost, right, of a frontline CDK inhibitor for years when they might do well on AI alone more than the median. So something like TK, to me, makes a lot of sense to say this is the group who's exquisitely sensitive and maybe doesn't need it. And that paper was sort of a look back at traditional studies to see whether it mattered, whether we deployed it first or second.
What about, and maybe you can just kind of give me, without doing a paper, maybe it would be cool to do a paper, but when I saw the title, what I was thinking was comparing first-line CDK to CDK after CDK. Like, right. How do you compare the benefit of the post-Monarch approach to using it up front?
Yep. Yeah, and I think, you know, the post-Monarch, the way that I think about those studies, maintain, post-Monarch, we had some retrospective data before post-Monarch, they all suggest that continued blockade with CDK inhibitor has some biologic activity, but the magnitude of that effect was limited. I think you would agree it was on the order of a couple of months for the most part. So if you look at what the other way to answer that question too is, when you look at EMBER-3, it was kind of interesting, the imlunestrant abemaciclib combo, 40% of those patients never had a prior CDK, 60% of those patients did have a prior CDK, and the magnitude of benefit on that arm wasn't hugely different. It was like 9 months versus 5 or 7 or something. So to answer your question there, it didn't seem like the magnitude of deploying abemaciclib with imlunestrant in the second line setting had a huge difference whether or not you received it the first time, which surprised me. I thought that the patients who'd never had abemaciclib would have really had a lot more benefit than the patients who had previously had a CDK inhibitor in the frontline setting. Maybe the SERD takes away some of that if you use a better anti-estrogen.
Again, maybe I'm getting too far out there, but again, these things pop into my mind. It kind of reminds me, the other issue here is abema a better CDKI than, you know, for example, in terms of efficacy compared particularly to palbo? Again, I sort of flashed on ALK, where, you know, a lot of people have been getting alectinib, and then lorlatinib came along that looks better. And yeah, you do see responses after alectinib to lorlatinib, but now everybody's giving lorlatinib up front. So do you think abema is a better CDK?
I used to think a lot about this when we were first doing the work in the lab about CDK resistance, and we knew that abema had different dosing schedule, potential CNS penetration, had a different kind of pharmacokinetic profile where it hit some other targets outside of 4-6, different, you know, as we said, different side effects. I do think it's a little bit of a different drug. And the whole idea of post-Monarch and our retrospective data was to sort of show that you could salvage patients who had maybe progressed on palbo or ribo with abema. Laboratory modeling of that has been really difficult. It's been really hard to prove in the lab that you can grow resistant to palbo and then be sensitive to abema, at least in cell culture, which again is obviously not as complex as a patient. So I do think that there are differential activities with abema. I think we can see some of that in the post-Monarch and the EMBER-3 data. But I also think we have newer drugs coming, next generation CDK4/2 drugs that are really active, much more so than abema, after progression on palbo or on ribo. These drugs are moving from phase 1, phase 2 into phase 3 in combination with some of these next generation antiestrogens. We have a really cool study we're about to open any minute now, looking at a next gen CDK4/2 inhibitor with Genentech in combination with giredestrant. And this drug has tremendous activity after progression on palbo, ribo, or abema. In laboratory models and in phase 1. So these newer drugs are hitting CDK2, which I think is the key target after progression on CDK4/6. And abema has a little bit of that, but not as much as the new ones. Oh, I was just going to say, the point you made is a great one about lorlatinib and alectinib. These new CDK4/2 inhibitors, which were sort of proven in lab and phase one models of CDK4/6 resistance, guess where they're being moved? Frontline. In precisely the same logic. Better drug, move it frontline, sort of hit the target harder to begin with. So we'll see if it holds up in breast cancer. I think it will.
Interesting. All right, let's get into your cases, starting out with this 65-year-old woman.
So this is a case of a 65-year-old patient, well-controlled hypertension, hypothyroidism, comes in with bone pain. She hasn't had a mammogram in a while. PET scan with diffuse osseous lesions and an FDG-avid right breast mass that's measuring 4 centimeters with lymphadenopathy. She gets a bone biopsy that's ER-positive, PR-positive, HER2-1+. We do baseline sequencing of the tissue from the bone, nothing actionable. We do baseline ctDNA. She's got a low TMB, stable microsatellite, no actionable alterations. We put her on letrozole and ribo. We see significant improvement in the bones, reduced FDG uptake. The breast mass shrinks. The regional lymph nodes shrink. She has sclerotic changes over time in the bone. She gets great control for 5 years. And then she has isolated progression after 5 years in one spot in the pelvis. Now, in this situation, I tend to try to call my friends in radiation to see if we can get more time. So we gave her XRT to that area. She continued letrozole and ribo for another six to nine months. Then she had more progressions and a couple of bone lesions and a couple of spots in the liver. Now we repeat the ctDNA. The TMB is still below 10, but now she's got two ESR1 mutations, D538 and Y537. The allelic fractions are, you know, less than 5%. She has an amplification in cyclin E1, which we've seen as a resistance driver to CDK. So we decided to put her on elacestrant, second line. She has good control with stability on the PET scan for 9 months. She has some further bone and liver progression with some new symptoms. Sure, TMB is 9. We still see the ESR1, but look, the allelic fraction is actually lower on the ESR1 after the elacestrant. We see some P53 and now FGFR changes, and we put her on TDXD because now she's symptomatic. She's got a 1+ IHC HER2. She's growing in the liver. We've already given her multiple lines of endocrine and CDK therapy. She does not have a PI3K pathway, and she didn't have an actionable FGFR that we saw. And so we put her on TDXD.
So a very common situation. It also brings up the issue how to look at the VAF. Like, is 5% or 3%? Is that high? Is it low? Is it more about how it changes? How do you look at that?
Yeah, I put that on here to sort of prompt, I think, this discussion. It can be affected by tumor purity, right? So you can see if you take multiple samples, little changes in VAF. I hesitate to sort of make big decisions based on the VAF. I think the point here is a low VAF, even if it's 1%, doesn't mean that you can't go after the target, right? Because what you're seeing in the blood may not be the actual VAF in all the individual cancer cells, because not all of them are shedding DNA into the blood. I do think, to your point, changes in time in the VAF is perhaps more important than what the number is itself. So for example, if you have a VAF that's rising over time in the same patient, it suggests that that population is becoming more and more pronounced or dominant. And look here, when we targeted the ESR1, we actually saw a drop in the VAF. Right. And then we see other things emerging like P53, et cetera. So I think the VAF is less important than the concept of present or absent. I think the VAF is more interesting in the same patient when you're tracking it over time. But I also think with the new data you and I looked at from SERENA-6, that we may have a future where we can use kind of on-target drops in VAF to kind of convince ourselves that our missile guidance is correct. We're hitting the target correctly, right, by seeing the drop in the VAF.
So another thing that's interesting about this patient had a good response for 5 years to CDKI. I'm curious what fraction of patients like this, I mean, she was de novo and all, but just what fraction like this, you know, do go for 5 years, and whether it helps predict. I mean, she had, you know, kind of a typical response, but how much of a difference in response do you see as it gets longer and longer out?
Yeah, I think she's also a great example of that Emerald subset data, right, where the patients who had the longer duration on the frontline right. CDK, you know, are the great candidates for elacestrant. You made the point, and I agree with it, that a de novo never before treated, strongly ER positive, bone only patient is most likely to have the best duration. This also brings up the question you had brought up a few minutes ago. Might she have been okay on an AI alone for a number of years, right? And we could have spared all the monitoring and the toxicity on the CDK. Maybe she could have been. I would say, you know, the median time on frontline CDK kind of all comers would be 2 to 3 years. I've had patients right. who progress within 2 to 6 months who are just upfront refractory. I've had a few patients who I've inherited from my colleagues. They're more than a decade. They've been on the drug since it was FDA approved, and they still have metastatic disease on the scan. They're not cured. You know, if we stop it, they have disease that would grow. A patient like this, I think, is really on the good end, probably in the top 20% or the top 15%. But I've seen longer. You know, in probably 10% or less of the patients, but she's in the upper quartile, I think.
So also, when I see cases like this, I'm used to the next step being, and the patient had a great response to TDXD. Did she?
Yeah, so she's doing well on TDXD, and as you guessed, you know, these patients who are chemo naive, right, even after several years of therapy, they tend to robustly respond. And again, this brings up the question, though, in clinic, who could be okay on CAPE? Right, with just oral therapy versus who needs IV TDXD. The data suggests, of course, from the Destiny Breast trials that the TDXD is better, but it's the same question with Sonia. Does everybody need TDXD, or can some people with this kind of disease get away with less?
So, I mean, this lady was 65, but why did you choose TDXD? Did you feel she needed? Was she symptomatic? Or
she was starting to have more symptoms, and we wanted to sort of use what we thought was going to be the most likely to drive a quick, like, deep response.
All right, let's hear about this 55-year-old woman.
So, 55-year-old patient with rheumatoid arthritis, doing well, not on therapy. She had a T1N1 ER-positive tumor in the past. Got surgery, TC chemo, radiation, letrozole for 5 years, and she's been off for 2 years now. So she had kind of standard frontline treatment, has refractory hip pain, had imaging concerning for bone lesions and lung nodules, FES. We did an FES PET, which is the ER signaling PET scan that we can talk about that was positive. Bone biopsy, again, ER positive, breast cancer, PR negative, HER2 zero. Sequencing showed the E545K sort of common PIK3CA mutation with a 30% allelic fraction, P53, ctDNA with a TMB just over the cut point at 11, stable microsatellite. We see the same PIK3CA, same TP53. She goes on AI ribo with Zometa, does okay, but not a huge response. She gets about 8 months with stability. Has worsening disease at that point. We repeat the ctDNA. She's got the same TMB, the same PIK3CA. Now she's got a couple different P53. She's got an RB mutation and an ESR1 with a 1% allelic fraction. So she's acquired RB and ESR1. So she's got second-line therapy. So we decided to give her fulvestrant with capivasertib, which we can talk about. She's got improvement in multiple areas, and she's had good control for about a year. Then she gets PET CT, new liver lesions, bone disease, the lung is stable. Her TMB is creeping up. She's 15. PIK3CA hasn't changed as it usually doesn't. We have multiple P53, RB, and NF1, but we don't see the ESR1 anymore. Liver biopsy, again, metastatic breast cancer, HER2 zero. You could tell I'm looking for the ultra low or the 1+. So I did a repeat liver biopsy. So we give her chemo with CAPE. She's got a good response for about 8 months, and then we give her sacituzumab, and that's where we're at now. So she got one line of chemo. We couldn't give her TDXD. She was HER2 null zero. We did an ADC with sacituzumab in the fourth line setting with some improvement.
So why did she lose her ESR1 on CAPI?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. The allelic fraction to begin with was quite low. It could have been that it was cleared with the fulvestrant and with the capivasertib. It could be that it's still there. It's just below the threshold of detection, that whatever's growing is kind of the nastier NF1, P53, RB, you know, mutant cells. I think when the allelic fraction is exceedingly low, like a fraction of a percent, you're right at that cut point of whether they can report it or not, and so you can see it fluctuate a little bit. It clearly, to the point we were making, over time is not rising, nor would I be super excited about giving endocrine monotherapy after she's already been through multiple lines of doublet therapy without a ton of response. I mean, the other reason with her compared to the first case, she was only on her frontline CDK for less than a year without robust response on her PET scan. So if you look at the Emerald subset data, even if she had the ESR1, she would have fallen into the category of patients who did kind of not as well as the patients who had longer durations, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, actually, it was 8 months that she progressed. Looks like she had a good response to Capi. So do you see the same thing with capivasertib, that with shorter time on CDK, they don't do as well? Or is it more about SERD?
Yeah, I don't think we have that data for Cap. It's a great question. I think anecdotally, I don't see quite the same correlation. And also, it's a doublet, and you're targeting a specific alteration like the PIK3CA. So I don't think I would view it the same way. If somebody had a reduced response on frontline, I don't think I would hesitate to use the Capi. The only time I might hesitate is if they're really in like visceral crisis and I need to quickly debulk them, where I would use conventional chemo or TDXD.
So is that one of the reasons that you used the Capi in this patient, that you know you were less enthusiastic about using a SERD because of the short time on CDK?
Right. Yeah. So I was less enthusiastic about single agent endocrine therapy, even if she had sort of a higher ESR1 allelic fraction. I wanted to use a doublet. She kind of had the, you know, you can almost sense that this patient isn't quite as endocrine sensitive based on what the scan looks like and how long the control is on the front line.
So you were going to comment on FES PET. I'm curious when you use it.
Yeah, we're starting to use a lot more of it. We're generating some data on this right now where you use it, I think, when you have imaging findings at baseline that you're not sure about. So, you know, FDG can light up for a lot of different reasons, right? Inflammation, autoimmune stuff, wound, you know, healing, infection, cancer. FES is highly, highly specific for breast cancer. And so if you're trying to get a sense of the amount of disease, or you have indeterminate findings like lung nodules that you can't access with bronchoscopy, I've also found in patients who had subtle CT findings and subtle FDG that the FES is more sensitive. I had a patient with an oligo lesion in the sternum on a CT that I couldn't figure out. Even on the FDG, it wasn't great. I did an FES. She had more disease in other areas that didn't show up on the FDG or on the CT. So the problem with FES is you can't really repeat it if they're on certain drugs. Like fulvestrant, the washout is 6 to 8 weeks. So you can't take someone off medicine for 6 to 8 weeks. On an AI, you can do it anytime. On a SERM, I think it's a few weeks, a couple of weeks. So depending on the drug they're on, there's a washout period, and that can really limit it. So it's a lot of times it's baseline. You're trying to figure out what's going on, if there's new imaging findings or the extent of disease isn't clear.
All right, let's finish out with your 78-year-old woman.
So I have a 3A and a 3B, and I had a feeling you would like the TK, so I brought you two variants on the TK testing.
Awesome.
So this is a 78-year-old patient with AFib on Eliquis. She had a T1N0 ER-positive tumor, got surgery, chemo, radiation, and an AI. She had a recurrence 6 years later and got anastrozole. This was an in-breast recurrence with a right mastectomy and switched over to fulvestrant. She then, this is in the setting of a recurrence, she then came back with back pain on fulvestrant. She had multifocal liver and bone lesions, and the liver biopsy showed ER positive, PR negative, HER2 1+. Targeted sequencing of the liver, negative. ctDNA with a TMB of 14, MS stable, P10 loss, NF1 and P53 mutations with an FGFR low-level amplification. So we put this patient, my colleagues did, on letrozole and abemaciclib. She progressed within 3 months, okay? Now, check out the TK value here. So her TK level, the thymidine kinase in the blood, at baseline was high at 400. When they put her on abemaciclib, she did not clear her TK. She did not go undetectable. And look, she has the P10 and the NF1 mutations, which are known drivers of resistance to CDK inhibitor. So if I had looked at her ctDNA and said, you know what, I'm worried about these mutations. We have data in the lab and we have data in other patients that they don't really do well. And her TK showed no drop and she progressed within the first 8 to 12 weeks. So this is an example of an unsuppressed TK level with genomic findings correlated to CDK resistance. Now, I'm bringing you to this abstract here. This is one of our fantastic fellows who's working with me, Elena Michaels. She's doing a really interesting project where she's laying the DNA results, the circulating tumor DNA, on top of the TK to show in patients who have known drivers of resistance to CDK what the pattern of TK is. And this patient was a perfect example of a patient who had a known resistance driver, no suppression of TK, and rapid progression clinically. So I think that shows potentially the utility of the TK test. Now, let me show you the flip side. So here's 3B, different patient, same series, okay? 70-year-old patient, healthy, comes in with diplopia and back pain. CT shows bony lesions, calvarial mass with some soft tissue extension. PET scan with mildly avid soft tissue nodule in the left breast and lytic lesions in the thoracic spine. Bone biopsy, ER positive, PR positive, HER2 low. The baseline ctDNA, TMB is around 10, MS stable, nothing actionable. She gets a kyphoplasty and radiation, and she goes on letrozole and abema. So she has some problems on the abema, has to dose adjust, gets down to 50 milligrams, and then has an excellent response, and she's still responding. So look at her TK. This is also very interesting. So she has a high TK. She starts CDK. She drops to almost undetectable. They hold her drug to dose adjust, and look what happens when they hold her drug. She pops up to 160. Then they get her back on drug at a better dose, and she goes back down. So this is a patient who has a deep drop in TK. It's sustained. She has no resistance mechanisms on her ctDNA. And when you're adjusting the dose, it's so sensitive that even when you're adjusting the dose, when she's off for a couple of weeks, you can see it flip back up, and then it flips down again.
So I'm just looking. Oh, yeah. So I'm curious about the diplopia. Did she have a retinal met?
I think she had some soft tissue extension that was pushing a little bit on the on like the occipital. So they did radiation. Yeah, they covered it with radiation.
Wow, interesting. You know, I've been flashing a lot on the whole idea of, you know, we used to have a neoadjuvant therapy to try to see whether people respond or not. And now I'm watching this thing, and we don't need neo. This is blood tests. You don't need tissue.
That's right.
So it's kind of like similar to how we used to Key 67 and all that, but now we're looking at the blood. So one final question I've got to throw out there before, one final question, which is, I mentioned we were doing this thing with ctDNA, and I did a program with Dr. Puzdai from Yale. And when I was looking up his CV, I saw this really cool paper he did. I don't know if you were aware of it. When they looked at SEER data, and they determined what fraction of breast cancer deaths are patients who originally started out with stage one. Are you familiar with that?
I don't think I've seen that data. He's a phenomenal expert on this topic too, and he's working with us on the thymidine kinase as well. What was the result of the SEER analysis?
Yeah, so what would you guess? What's your guess? No. Of all the people who die of breast cancer, what fraction of them were originally stage one?
My gut tells me, I'm just thinking about my own practice, that it would be relatively low, probably on the order of 10 to 20%, but it might be a surprising number.
23%.
Okay, so on the upper end of that, yeah. But I mean, I think because you see this, right, there's some biology there that even though you caught it early, there's still some sort of propensity, yeah, right, for those patients.
Yeah, well, that's kind of his point, that even though it's a very low-risk situation, there's so many people who are stage one that it's a quarter of breast cancer deaths. So my question to you is, thinking about all the technology you've just been discussing, how would you apply it to that specific problem, finding those stage one patients who maybe we need to approach differently?
Yeah, and I think you brought up a great concept earlier about AI. There may be a way to look at those patients and look at their genomic profiles with some of these newer sequencing platforms and start to derive a signature for patients who have higher propensity for recurrence, right? Oncotype kind of gets at that, but it's a small number of genes and it's gene expression. And when you were telling me the story, I was just thinking about a few patients I've had who had very low oncotypes, right? They had stage one or stage two disease. Their oncotype was very low. We forgo chemotherapy. We give them endocrine therapy, but they recur. Now, it hasn't happened a lot, but it's happened a couple of times. And the point that I teach the fellows when we're sitting in clinic and dealing with this rare but sad situation is that Oncotype tells you the overall risk of recurrence. If it recurs, it doesn't tell you how it's going to behave. Because I've had patients with very low Oncotype who, when they recur, it's not an indolent, necessarily ER-sensitive tumor that does well for 10 years. It can be an extremely aggressive tumor. And I think that's the point you're making here. Just because it's stage one, when they recur, it doesn't mean that they're not going to die from, unfortunately, from the breast cancer. That original biology doesn't dictate the course of the disease. So we may be able to use some of these deeper sequencing tools, even in the primary tumor, where there may be tiny, tiny fractions of these bad mutations, to start to say, uh-oh, like this person might have the capacity for a more difficult recurrence later on. And to your point, maybe we shouldn't be thinking about them like a stage one. Maybe they need, you know, more chemo, or maybe they need 10 years on endocrine therapy, or maybe they need Signatera monitoring, right, or something like that, even though you wouldn't think necessarily from the pathology and the anatomy that they should get there. It's a very interesting finding, and kind of matches to some extent that feeling with the Oncotype of those rare recurrences with the Oncotype of 5, right, or something like that.
This concludes our program. Relevant financial relationships for the faculty can be found in the program notes. Note that the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may be discussed in this program, so check out the package inserts for more information. Special thanks to Dr. Wander, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today, optimizing biomarker assessment and related treatment decision-making for patients with hormone receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer.